question you get your
we used to ask is what you would do if you had $1 million. You didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had a million.
Hello, Northbank, Saxon, Jackson. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 11. Up. NASDAQ Futures up 131 after yesterday's pretty much fiasco with the market. We were down huge. Now, these things don't really, you know, I don't really watch the cash that much, but we got the S&P down 107 yesterday. That is pretty accurate. NASDAQ down 579, but really the futures were down 950. So it was a pretty rough day. The Dow wasn't down so much because a couple stocks in the Dow, IBM and a couple were actually up quite a bit. And Carl talked about it yesterday, and we will get more about him on a Friday regarding the individual stocks. I mean, some of the cost of the people, I mean, he's been talking for a while about how the cost of, like, kind of the regular memory, the old-fashioned memory, has been really going to the moon, because he's basically dicking around computers all the time. It went from $100 or whatever he was talking about to $500. Now that prices are starting to come off. So the people who make that stuff, like the Microns of the world, that might be going to affect them negatively, but the firms that buy that stuff, like IBM and maybe Microsoft and a couple others. So there's actually kind of a rotation going on, possibly, in the tech area, which is makes it even more difficult to... So, I mean, a lot of my clients have those stocks, and it's not just, you know, a while ago, you could just say, well, just put your anything in the queues, you know, the top seven stocks, put it in there, and you were, quote, in tech. Well, okay, you're in tech, but now some of the tech looks to be doing good and some not so much, so... It's actually pretty difficult even in all the areas now. I understand we have Mr. Murphy. We probably have Mr. Kevin as well.
We have both of us, and yeah, Mike and I were just chatting a little bit, but yeah, we should have Mike sort of catch us up on the status of the tournament at this point.
Before we do that, what's his name? Your guy got tossed by the NFL, a quarterback. What, they won't let him in the draft?
Oh, you know what? I didn't see the news. Yesterday, I was in the office all day and then at class at night, so I haven't seen any news out of yesterday.
He didn't really get tossed, Tom. They're just not having a supplemental draft this year. So he essentially was blacklisted, or however you want to phrase it.
So he would have been the only guy in there. They said rather than have him in there, we're just not having it? Wow.
Right, because of their stance on gambling. So that's why they're not having it.
How can they do that, I guess? So that now, can he go back to college now?
Sounds like they've essentially given him a one-year suspension.
Yeah. Well, can he go back to college?
No, because Texas Tech, I don't think, will let him play. So, maybe he could, because he's suspended for only two games, I think, for the gambling. So we'll have to see how all that plays out.
Well, the headline I heard, just the one headline I heard on News Radio 78 said they didn't want him back, so he's got no place to play. Now, whether that's true or not, that's kind of what I was, to be determined. So what about the soccer?
Canadian Football League.
Yeah, so what about this? Hey, you know, one of our listeners, Mike, after the show last week, and I was, you know, stumbling around, I was asking you, like, where do they stay, you know, like at universities and stuff. my clients from, client and listeners from Santa Barbara, he goes, what are you talking about? There's two teams here. They have the two 5-star hotels. They're living
right,
large.
Right, exactly. Well, they're staying at 5-star hotels probably, and they're also they're practicing at universities too. So, and the U.S. team was south of L.A. because they're playing two games in Los Angeles. And as a matter of fact, the game on Thursday night is against Turkey. So we'll see how that one plays out, too.
Those are in that big new football place where the two teams play, the Rams and the...
Yes, the SoFi Stadium. So
that's nice. Now, is just in terms of dimensions, a regular football field, can you go play soccer the next day, or do you have to widen it somehow? Is it the same size field?
I think you have to widen it a little bit, but I'm not sure about that. They're both rough. Well, I think a soccer field is 110 yards for some reason. So, and I think it might be a little wider, but I'm not sure about that.
All right. So what you mentioned last week that with 48 teams, there's a lot of games that aren't the best. Boy, you're right about that, huh?
Well, after, so we have another week of the play-in games to get to the round of 32. And so you still have another week of seeming, or there could be some weak games in there. It just depends on how it, and I've looked at all the groups. I kind of think I have the people picked that are going to win, at least come in first or second in the group. And you guys asked about there will be 32 teams in this next round. Okay, we started out with 48, and there were 12 groups. So I think, by the way that I'm thinking it, the top eight third-place teams, by their points in their group, they will end up getting into the round of 32. Because 12 teams, two apiece, that's the 24, and then so you got eight to make another, to make the 32.
Before they went to 48, how many people made it to the, what's the term, the knockout round?
Well, they used to start out with the 32, and 16 teams made it to the knockout round.
So there's essentially one extra game. It would be like if the NCAA went one extra game or something.
That's about right. Yes, I think that's what it is.
So it's going to be the number one team versus the crummiest team. Is it that way?
The way they do the seeding is based upon the points in their group, and it'll generally be like the stronger teams in a group will get a better seed. Although, see, and this is where it gets. And this is what I don't understand about the tournament is, for instance, Brazil and Morocco tied. They are both strong teams. So they will end up being tied most likely in their group. So their point total will be a little low. So I don't know how they will be treated. But, for instance, France has won two games. The U.S. has won two games. Argentina has won two. And all three of those teams should win their third game. So they'll have a lot of points, so their seeding will be much better. So they could end up being ranked like 1 through 4, 1 through 3, however many.
So there's allegedly a reason for the U.S. to not play the bench in this game, even though they've already won the group.
Well, I think they will play the bench because they have guys with yellow cards, which is and they don't want those people to be penalized so that they're suspended from the first game in the next round, so in the round of 32. So they're going to rest those guys. Pulisic might play a half, for instance. They want to get him back into game shape. But they're going to be very leery of him getting injured again. But McKinney will probably play, although he has a yellow card, so he might rest too. And there's other guys on the U.S. that have yellow cards that they need to just sit. So, but it'll be a great opportunity for the second string guys, or really the 1.5 string guys, to play and then score and make themselves more palatable for the later rounds.
Right, but if you put... You still only get the five subs, right? So you can't really. I mean, you still got to play a lot of your good guys, right?
Yes, but I'm sure that the U.S. has a pretty strong 26, so they'll two or three of those will be goalies or goalkeepers, but they'll still field a pretty credible team. England needs to win their next game, so they're going to come out strong, for instance. I don't think Mexico needs to worry about who they're playing. So I could go down the groups, and I'll tell you who I think. Well, I might have done that a little bit last week, too. But okay, so today Group A plays, and that's Mexico, the Czech Republic, South Africa, and South Korea. The two teams that I think that will go out of that group are Mexico and South Korea. Group B is Canada, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Qatar, and Switzerland. Switzerland's going to go from that group, and then I think it's a crapshoot for the rest of it, but I think Canada's got as good a chance as anybody. And then in Group C, it's Brazil and Morocco. In Group D, it's the U.S., and then I'm not sure, because Australia and Paraguay will play. They each have 3 points apiece, and then Turkey's already eliminated. In Group E is Germany, and then it's a kind of a crapshoot for the rest. Group F is the Netherlands has won their two games, and actually Germany won their two games also. But then the rest of the Netherlands group, well, it'll be between Japan and Sweden for the number two in that group.
Is there any team that you absolutely convinced last week was going to make it that's out?
No, because there's like Argentina, for instance, they'll go far, as will France, and they've each won both of their games, and Messi has scored all the goals for Argentina. He's been pretty good, and then Mbappe for France has scored 4 goals for them. So we'll see, but they will make the final eight, I think, for sure. I actually think Portugal may make the final eight, although they were weaker than I thought they would be in the first round.
Based on last week, Argentina looks stronger than you predicted.
Argentina is pretty strong, but if I had to make a prediction now, I would say the finals will be Argentina versus France, but you don't know how the knockout games are going to go. So if they're in the same bracket on their side, but the odds are FIFA will not do that, I'll still say it's going to be Argentina versus France.
You said those guys were young, and they must be growing up pretty quick.
Which guys?
Argentina.
Yes, but they're led by Messi, and he still has veterans that he's played with for the last, 12 years. And they will go far because of, Messi and because of his experienced compadres on Argentina.
So they got a few veterans sprinkled in with the other guys. They're learning pretty fast.
That's right. They are.
What, two things. I was having dinner with my bros on Sunday, and my nephews are kind of into this. I don't know if they're as knowledgeable about it as you are, but my nephew was talking about how the amount of private jets for the FEMA people, he goes, it's really something unbelievable, the amount of money these guys spend. And one of the guys that I was talking to said when Rahm Emanuel, all the way back when this was planned, I guess he was mayor or something, I don't know, but maybe it was the last. But if you get a game, the city has to pony up like all the lodging, all the everything for the teams that are here. I mean, it's a really a big chunk you take out of the city if you want the game here.
Well, and that's the thing about, and it's FIFA, Tom, not FEMA.
FEMA's the if you get a tornado, you get FEMA, right?
That's correct. But when FIFA comes to town, I guess it is like a tornado because they are the most corrupt organization, I think, in sports. I think they're worse than the NCAA. Their president has been, actually, he's been fired a couple of times. They had the World Cup in Russia, and then they had the World Cup in Qatar. So you think there were any bribes involved in that to get those games in Russia and Qatar?
How did they do it in Russia? Was it all in Moscow? Where was it?
No, it was all over the place. It was in a lot of their major cities. Sochi was one of them, which is where they staged the Olympics. Moscow was one of the... Probably St. Petersburg. I'd have to look at a map of Russia. But it was their main games were all in Moscow, though, for the most part.
Well, they're getting the private jets. The rest of the people got a little problem getting around in Russia, I think.
Right. Well, they could take that great train system that they have. So
they have two trains, don't they? One, two across. It's about the whole. But I mean, well, what for somebody like me? And I'll just lob this one out there. I watched a few of these games, and some of them, it seems to me, even the U.S. game, it seems like they can. Some are really interesting to watch. Some just sort of degrade, and every time the ref's looking the other way, somebody kind of takes a cheap shot. The guy goes down like he's dead. They all argue for 5 minutes while the clock's running, instead of the referee stopping the clock and saying, "All right, we're going to argue for 5 minutes like you would in football, or our football." And it really, there was like no, there wasn't a shot on goal in the whole second half. Some of those games kind of really degrade down. Or if you're playing in them, I'm sure it's fine, but watching them, you're going, what are they doing? I mean, is it just me not being that much of a soccer aficionado, or is it noticeable even to guys like you that really love it?
No, there are some that that are sometimes slow. But yesterday, there was a nil-nil game, and I forget, doggone it. It wasn't the Argentina game. Oh, it was, well, Portugal was an interesting game, even though they won 3-0. Oh, England and Ghana was a great game, and they scored nothing, so it was nil-nil. So
Ghana, is that good?
No, I'm sorry. It was, Ghana played a very strong defensive game. They tried to counterattack every once in a while, and it did work. And Panama and Croatia, that was also an interesting game, although Croatia won that one 1-0. But they scored in like the 85th minute or the 82nd minute. So they were hanging on for dear life, because if they would have tied, I don't think they would have made the round of 32. But now their chances are much better because they won the game.
What was that goalie? What team's he on? The guy who had like the 12 saves? I haven't seen 12 shots yet. One guy made 12 saves?
Actually, somebody made 15 or 16.
That was a guy, 15, yeah.
Yeah, that was Room. I think he's on Curacao, and I think it might have been against Germany. So he kept them in the game, and the Cape Verde goalie also kept them in the game against Spain, but Spain ended up, Spain beat Saudi Arabia, I think, and Uruguay ended up beating Cape Verde, I think.
Well, at some point, the guy had to yell out there, "Hey, guys, how about a little D?"
Well, unfortunately, when you're playing against some of these better teams that pass the ball well and just are focused on remaining on their end or on the offensive side of the field, they play pretty well. So.
But if you do that, though, I have seen a couple of breakaways. I haven't seen any that score, but I've seen a couple that came pretty damn close. They're pretty exciting.
Well, and that's the thing with some of these teams. Like Ghana they didn't play stall ball. They just played a very stalwart defense, and then they tried a counterattack. And Panama tried to counterattack. They just couldn't put the ball in the goal. And Spain, when Spain plays, they're always on the offensive, so teams, for instance, can go after them in a counterattack. So you get good teams, and sometimes they will end up beating Spain.
Mike, what is the offside rule? Everybody's got to seem like a different. Most people think they know it, and then when you ask them what it is, they can't tell you. What is it?
So when you're in the offensive end, all of your, when the pass is made to a person that is advancing or attacking, they have to be behind the last defensive person. They have to remain on onside. They cannot cross the line of the last defenders.
So you can't cherry pick, essentially.
Exactly. So I would have had a hard time.
You can't freelance.
You can't what, Kevin?
Freelance.
No, that's right. Yeah, exactly.
Because there's no, but I mean, you wouldn't stay back there anyway. Well, I guess you could. I mean, but it just seems kind of weird. So you can't.
Well, if you watch Argentina play, watch how Messi, he kind of hangs in the back, and then if there's rebounds or, you know, like a pass from right near the goal, he's generally in a position to put the ball in the net. And that's where he's really strong. His footwork is so good. Harry Kane is the same way for England, although Harry Kane missed a couple of bunnies yesterday that he should have made, at least one that he really should have made toward the end of the game. So, and there's guys on, well, not Freeman, because he played very well for the U.S., but he scored on, not a breakaway, but he pretty much set it up himself. There are teams that get down the field using the wings, and then they send that cross into the middle, and then some of their bigger guys like to go after those crosses. Norway has that type of capability, as does the Netherlands.
Well, Norway's got that guy. It's huge.
Right, Haaland, or H-A-A-L-A-N-D, Haaland.
He's quite the player, that guy.
Yeah, he is big. He'd be a tight end or an offensive lineman in
But now, just a minute, I don't want to beat this up too much, but I understand if everybody else runs down the field and you just kind of hang back like cherry picking in basketball, you can't do that. But what if the whole play is on that end and you just happen to be deeper than the defensive guy between him and the goalie? Can you do that or no?
You can get a pass on like a breakaway if you left from your end of the field, so from the defensive end of the field, and you'll see a couple of those maybe a game. It depends on how good the teams are, but the onside or offside rule does keep people from doing that cherry picking.
But you could if you're on your side of the defender and the guy launches one downfield and you outrace the defender to the ball, you're okay, right? That's where you start.
That's correct. That's when these guys with speed. Like, there was a guy on Panama yesterday, and he played very well. His name was Martinez. And he kept dominating play on his wing. He played very well. It's just that the rest of the Panamanians couldn't put the ball in.
But once you're down there and under the attack.
Let me clarify a little bit, Tom, because what you're asking is, it first of all, the offside is judged by when the foot meets ball. Not if you can outrun everybody and you can run past them, even if it's while the ball is in the air or somebody really launches one, if you're onside when foot meets ball, you're okay.
Okay, but when you're
that is correct, Kevin, and that's where like Mbappe, because he's really fast and quick. He generally, but he's always pushing the offside. So sometimes he gets caught, and sometimes he doesn't. Yep. So, but now that they have the video cameras and they use them well. It's very rare that that people get away with being offside.
And it's I've seen a couple of instances where it goes the other way too, where they think the play continues, the guy gets his goal, and then they review it to see if he was onside or offside, and the review will reveal that he was okay, just barely, but he was okay.
That's correct, and that's what happened with Freeman when the U.S. was playing. He had a header that they originally called wasn't a goal, and then they did the video review, and he ends up getting a goal. So
we're still at one ref and two side judges, right?
That's correct.
So they didn't add another guy or anything like they did in hockey.
Well, but they have three people up in the video review booth, so they've essentially added three to the process because they're making calls up in the video booth, and it's a very experienced referee, and then that feedback immediately goes to the ref on the field.
So what do you do if you have a game when there is no booth up there? What if it's like a regular field? Then what do you do?
The booth is in New York or wherever it is. They have a video review booth for every game, regardless of where the game is.
I'm just talking about a regular soccer game for like high school or something. Seems like there is no video booth. There's only three guys.
Oh no, there's no video booth in like a high school soccer game.
So you're still down to one guy trying to watch 22 people.
But there's actually three people watching 22 because the side refs have the ability to make a call on fouls and things like that.
I mean, my niece was playing soccer, you know, when she's high school. My brother goes, they got some teams, the minute the ref turns the other way, they cheap shot somebody. It was kind of all the way up the chain. It was the girls, for God's sake.
Right.
With all the money, who makes the dough here, I guess, is the question. I mean, the cities, I guess, for the cities to pony up all that money to take care of these guys, who gets the gate?
I imagine FIFA gets a great majority of the gate. But I really don't know how the proceeds, and I should know more than that. But I'm pretty sure FIFA gets the gate, but the way that these fans are traveling for this, the city benefits because you get all those soccer fans coming to your town for, like in Philly, I think they're playing 7 games in Philly. They're playing 7 in Vancouver. I don't know how many L.A. has. They probably have about 7 also. So.
Well, the Scots essentially ranked the beer out of Boston, right, or something?
Supposedly, yeah. And then the English were up there yesterday in pouring down rain, and that's another reason why the game was nothing, because it was...
What's the story on the rain? Because I saw, of course, I'm sitting in the adult emporium the other night with a guy who knows everything about soccer, and it's pouring rain, and he goes, these guys play to winning. It's not like, you know, candy-ass baseball or something, and all of a sudden there's this rain delay. I go, looks to me like there's a rain delay. What are you talking about?
They were worried about lightning, so thunder and lightning still will stop a game. It's just like football, too.
That Philly Stadium, it didn't look like the football stadium, is it?
I think it is. I think
it is.
I never noticed that big, huge upper deck in the middle of the field on that that stadium. That's pretty neat. I think I've never seen it like that before. They were panning up to see the rain, so you actually could see the upper deck. The upper deck there is, it goes from, I'll say, goal line to goal line, and it really goes high in the middle. So if you're up there, you're in the middle of the field. You're not in the corner. You're not in the end zone. It's pretty weird.
Right. Well, I haven't been to Philly into that stadium. I think we went to the old stadium before, and we've been to the baseball stadium, but I don't know
What a baseball stadium. I had seats there that my buddy Shanny got me, right? I probably, if it was Wrigley, I'd have been about the height of the light tower on Sheffield. That's how far away I was. I was sitting next to Bob Uecker, to put it bluntly. They got some seats way the hell out there in Philly. It's not a bad place, but anyway. So what right now is there, this week we're going to cut down to 32, which is where they used to start out, which means this thing's quite a longer deal. And then that's just... How they have a game every 4 days, 3 days, 5 days? How long does it take to play out? They're done. They're done in a few weeks, right?
You know, it's in these early rounds we have the game every day. And I think it'll be every second or third day, perhaps after this round. But I haven't located, but I haven't looked real hard yet because the second round is determined by how well you do in the first round. So, for instance, a pretty strong team like Norway's pretty good, but they could end up in second place because they're pitted against France. So Norway could end up playing, for instance, like the U.S. or Argentina. So the second round, really, the top teams will end up playing one of those third-place teams, and then you'll have the middle group that we'll see how that works out. But everything's geared on who wins the group and then how strong your record is within your individual group.
If a schlump team, say somebody's ranked number one, say France, and there's somebody ranked 32, so they play each other. If the 32 team beats the one team, do they take over that seeding, like in NCAA, or is it like hockey where they reseed?
No, it would be, I think that they would end up staying in the same seed that they just replaced France. So, you know, they won't be a number one seed, but they'll get reseeded a little bit.
But they'll play as if France would have won. They play the next game.
That's correct.
So like the NCAA, not like hockey.
That's correct.
Right.
Yeah.
What is Hackey do again, Kevin?
I don't know. I don't know if that. I didn't know that Hackey recedes.
I know they do. I've never actually cared enough to see what they did. But yeah, you know, they recede. So if the crummiest team beats the best team, then they got to beat the second best team, which is kind of bizarre. But so I mean, if you come from the bottom heap in Hackey, you deserve it. Let's put it that way. I think they used to, maybe they still don't do that, but they used to. They reseed. So, are you if you were a huge betting man, Mike, who would you be on? And is there an odds-on favorite? You keep saying France.
I would still say that the odds-on favorites are both France and Argentina, and Netherlands could do pretty well. Spain is always tough. Belgium, they keep talking about how they should do well, but I think they're past their prime too, as is Croatia. Actually, I think the U.S. has a decent chance. I think they'll be, I hope they will be in the final eight. And then after that, it's kind of a crapshoot.
Where is the final eight, all in the same city or still spread around?
No, they'll, because I'm sure that the, and this is another thing that I haven't seen before. This is the first time where the tournament's been in three different countries. So the opening, the opening game was, I think, in the U.S. It might not have been, actually. But you have Mexico and Canada will each have a probably the semifinal games, and then I know that the final, I think the final anyways, is on July 19th in New York City. Well, in the Giants and Jets Stadium, MetLife. So that's where they finish, and I'm assuming on the 19th it'll be like it'll start at 7 or 9 at night. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh. In between my nephew and you, I'm getting a pretty good view of this place. When you say corrupt, who follows the dough? I mean, who gets the sponsorship at Met Stadium? Do they control all that? Is it like the Olympics where, Kevin, weren't you the guy that said when they had the Olympics in London, if Nike had, I think they paid up for the sponsorship, that anybody who had an Adidas sign on their building that might have been there for 30 years had to take it down or cover it up or something? Is it that intrusive?
I don't think that was me telling you that, but
it was
Tom, for instance. Okay, you know the MetLife Stadium, so that's New York and New Jersey, or New Jersey and New York. They don't have any sponsorship. It's all FIFA, and like in Dallas, it was FIFA. It wasn't AT&T Stadium. So Seattle Lumen Field, it's just Seattle Washington Stadium. So I don't think those people paid FIFA, so they don't get to they don't sponsor, or their name isn't mentioned.
Yeah, their stadium naming rights are never mentioned. They are words not spoken.
That's correct.
How do you, if the three of us got into a home remodeling business and we sponsored our name on top of a stadium, the Notre Dame remodeling business, and we sign a contract for that place, how does somebody supersede that and say you can't call it Notre Dame Stadium for that week?
FIFA has that much power, Tom. That's what I think. They just take away any of the naming rights. The naming rights don't apply to an international organization, is what I'm thinking.
I know the.
And if you insist, and then you're not getting, you know, we'll just play in a different city.
That's right. Well, you're not getting the game. That's correct.
Well, I guess my question is, what does the city tell us after they sold it to us? How many times can you sell it to the same thing?
I don't understand the question, Tom.
Well, okay, so it's AT&T Stadium's Dallas, right?
Right.
Okay, so FIFA comes to town, they say, look, this is going to be Dallas Stadium while we're here. Well, somebody's got to make the call to AT&T. What do you tell them?
Well, that's up to Jerry Jones, since that's his field. So, you know, they can tell them to pound sand, because it's not – well, I don't know how the legalities of it. You'd have to talk to all your lawyer and judge buddies.
I'm sure it partly depends on what the naming rights contract says.
Yep.
And whether they even – could have contemplated this when they negotiated the deal, but there may be some standard language in there that just, you know, it sort of explains that whole thing and deals with it. And maybe there isn't. Maybe they have to go knock on the door and have conversations with the naming rights sponsor and say, you know, it just might slip out once in a while that you're really AT&T Stadium, but otherwise, if you would like us to host here, this is the way it's going to have to be.
Well, if there's enough money around and it's spread around, this can all be made to happen. We all know that, right?
But if
FIFA controls the entire purse through this whole mess, does anybody audit these guys ever?
Yes, they do get audited. When the president of FIFA was audited, or whatever their title is, the CEO of FIFA, the guy ended up going to jail. Now, he was Swiss, I think, and it might have been like a rather minor sentence, but he did go to jail.
This is because I'd love to find out. I mean, the cities must feel they're getting a decent deal. I mean, at the end of the day, do you think it was worth it to Philly in L.A.?
Oh, yeah, I think it's worth it, because look at all the fans they bring in. You know, Boston, as you said, the Scottish drank they essentially drank the town dry. And I'm sure, you know, in Mexico City or in L.A., the Hispanic population attends games very well. And I'm sure they drink whatever liquid they're going to drink too, whether it's tequila or Corona or whatever.
Well, but the thing of it is, everybody, especially everybody who loves sports, which puts us in the group, you get the idea that if, you know, 15,000 people show up, or 20, for a weekend soccer game, it's terrific. And everybody does nothing but blow smoke up your behind on how terrific it is for a city. But if it's Chicago, if every one of the hotels would have been full anyway with a Housewares convention, and they have to leave that, you know, McCormick Place isn't going to have a convention that week because they know soccer's coming, you're just replacing one for the other. I mean, it's not always new money, is what I'm saying. And even though people think it is,
maybe part of why Chicago doesn't have it, isn't hosting, and some other cities are, because, you know, how booked up are Seattle for conventions? How booked up is Kansas City and so on? How about Guadalajara? Do they have a lot of conventions?
Well, Guadalajara
has a its own tourism industry anyway. But I'll also say that my sense of this, without any empirical data to support it, is that the international fans travel for this like no other. We may be seeing more fans, more people coming to these cities than you would see for, you know, World Series or something like that, when the visiting team fans might want to travel. That's just my sense of it, is that people are, you know, have been planning around this for a couple of years. They've been planning their trips to the U.S. And not only are they coming to the host cities and traveling around, but they're also hitting up a lot of places. They're hitting up every damn Buc-ee's in between.
I'm saying on the surface, and probably all the way down, but you guys, you've known me for how long? The Bodie is, as they say in the South Side. I'm always going to ask the next question. I mean, I have Bear fans that say, oh, man, you need the Bears in the city, which I don't know what the hell they're doing going to Hammond, but that's another story. You need the Bears in the city because
but that's okay.
Well, I don't think there's much difference, really, between Hammond and Arlington Park. From downtown, it's easier to get to Hammond, but that's another story. But I'm saying, if somebody will say, what do you mean, the Bears? Look at how many people come here to watch the Bears. And I go, how many people? Well, 10,000, 12,000 every week. Okay, that's fine. By the way, you know, the Bears travel pretty well. Do you know what that means? What are you talking about? There's probably 10,000 Bear fans that are going to be in Philadelphia Stadium next weekend to watch the Bears play the Eagle. They just left Chicago, so their money for the weekend is being spent in Philadelphia versus Chicago. So the same amount of people leave on a road game as come on a... Man, I never thought of that. I mean, when people gush about how much money they're worth to the place, I always sit back and say, wait a minute, are you really? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I think places like Wrigley and Fenway, maybe because they're kind of unusual places are probably net positives, but I'm not so sure the other places are. If you really want to go through the whole, I mean, I'm saying I'd like to see the detail. I think you're right, Kevin. We're not going to get 15,000 people from Scotland here if the World Cup wasn't here. But who are they displacing? Are the people they displacing going to another city for their convention, in which case they benefit? I mean, all kinds of strings are to this, right? I mean, I'm going to say that if Chicago has to, well, they don't have a game, but if they have to toss out a convention or two or three or four this week, the convention is either going to schedule another week or they might be in another city, which is a benefit of another city, right? So, I mean, it is a net positive, I think, but I just don't want to believe that it's all gravy, you know what I'm saying? Because it's not all gravy, probably. And how much do these FIFA guys make? I mean, how much is left here? It sounds to me like we want to be in the private jet business for those guys.
I think you're right about that. And the way that I consider this is you're just adding crowds to the cities. Because, for instance, I know in Houston last week they had a huge parade of the Dutch going to the stadium when they played Sweden. So, you know, that all of that revenue coming into the city is just extra revenue with the Dutch fans. And then, you know, there was another game in Houston this week, and I don't know what fans it were, but the place was packed again. So it's another set, because some of these fans are following their team from city to city. So you're bringing money into really the whole East Coast because, you know, Boston did well with the Scottish, and then they've had the English there yesterday, and they'll get some other team. And Philly's done well because they've had two or three games there. So it's seven times 80,000 people coming to your city. So, for the cities that have a lot of games. So,
well, how much of the 80,000 people in Met Stadium, how many of them are from out of town, you think? It's probably not half.
I think at least half or two-thirds are from out of town. Because it was New York. The Brazil-Morocco game was in New York. And it was half the stadium was Brazilians and half was Moroccans. And I doubt that, well, there might be a bunch of Brazilians on the East Coast, but I don't know about Moroccans. So
I don't think 40,000 people have the money from Ghana to show up in New York.
I mean, I think they do.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I should have taken pictures when boy, Mike, you would have filtered right in with this crew. When the Irish rugby team, was it last fall, played for the first time in 4 years, the New Zealand All Blacks, Soldier Field, you would not believe the amount of people here from Ireland for that game. And the guy downstairs, O'Neill's, somehow he got wind of it or something and got to close the street and back. And he had a lot of the Irish insiders were downstairs, and I walked through the place, and I never saw so many big Irish guys in my life. I think for the 3-day weekend, 150, 200 cases of Guinness or something, incredible number. They on Saturday, they started at like 9 in the morning, went to the game, came back. They had to almost call the police to get them out at 2. What do you mean you're closing? They were there since. They did incredibly well. So you're right. If you're one of the places where that's the place to be, God, it makes your year. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean,
I'm sure in Seattle their year has been made. Boston, you know, they're doing very well. Philly's doing well. Dallas. And all of those towns had to, or all those cities had to wine and dine the FIFA guys at one point or another. So that's why I'm saying it's a pretty corrupt organization.
Well, at the end of the day, you think all these people got that kind of money, or is it you know, expats from the place going to these games?
I think it could be expats from going to these games, but people are traveling, you know, for this. And look at the administration was pushing, you know, the World Cup tickets, and whoever, you know, purchase tickets and your visa, So you got a little bit of special treatment from our government to make sure you made it to the games that you bought tickets to, too. So it's kind of a fascinating enterprise is what it comes down to.
But, I mean, do you really have to – I guess if you don't have a private jet and your team keeps winning, how long are you here? 6 weeks? Where the hell – how do you stay 500 hours a night for 6 weeks if you're from Ghana, for
yeah,
God's sake?
That one you got me, Tom, and, you know, who knows?
But I could see if your team is playing – if you're from Mexico and your Mexico is playing in New York – I could see piling in the truck and heading to New York, but I'm not going to stay there for 6 weeks. How am I going to do that?
No, but that's who knows. They'll figure it out if they want to see the games.
Well, so there have been no teams that you really thought were good that are going to be out. Sounds
not
like.
Yet. No, I thought Portugal was a little weak in their first game, but then they won yesterday 3-0. So
if I was going to bet a long shot here, not that I don't even have an account anywhere, but. Who'd be your long shot? Maybe because I watched that Norway game and how good that guy was, I have a little soft spot for that team. Am I just overplaying them?
I think you're overplaying them. Morocco could be an upstart because no African team has ever gone. I don't know that they've ever made the semifinals, and they played Brazil pretty tough. And Brazil is like the third ranked team, I think, in the world, either third or fourth. So that will be. Well, Morocco could be interesting. Brazil is on the upswing, although they are not as good as they have been in the past. If France gets beat, I'll be surprised. And I think Argentina is susceptible because Messi, somehow somebody's going to shut down Messi, and that'll make the other guys, they'll have to score, but they've done that in the past, so... We'll see how it goes.
Well, Tom, while we were waiting in the queue, I mean, and this is a messy observation, but it's a lot of people. You know, older players, and, you know, we know this, having competed at our own levels, as an older player, you're going to have your moments where you flash and you're, you know, like as good as you always were. But those are moments. They're not what you do every game, because as you get older, you know, you get recovery times, you have, you know, and your skills start to deteriorate. So when you're looking at someone like Messi, he's going to do some fantastic things in this tournament, and sometimes he's going to look like a guy who's ready for retirement.
Well, the only thing
he's still going to be good, but he's not going to be what we've known him to be every game. Maybe he will. Maybe this is his last hurrah, and it's going to be great. But, you know, if he's like most human beings, there's going to be the days when he can't carry the whole team. And like Mike said, then that's, you know, that's when you start to say, is that when they get knocked out? And, who knows the answer?
Well, one thing from my own personal experience, and by the way, you guys chime in if you know, the first time I noticed that I was degrading a hair, it didn't really come... When I was doing anything, I was probably in 7 or 8 handball tournaments, but I, you know, wasn't like the best guys or anything. They were just tournaments at the club and so forth. And it seemed like I'm probably in my late 30s, and I noticed that I could still do stuff about as much as I ever could, but all of a sudden, if I had a game where I won the first round at like 10 o'clock in the morning and had to sit for 2 hours. Before I played the next game, that became very, very difficult. And I'm thinking a game like soccer, because once you start, you pretty much stay warmed up the whole way. It's probably a little easier in that regard. Now, Messi still, he's you know, I mean, the guy's a spectacular. But one thing I couldn't do was stop and get back in. I mean, otherwise, I mean, that was, to me, when I started to degrade physically, that's the first I noticed it. I could have played two matches in a row, but if I had an hour or two gap, I had a problem.
I went from being easily safe going from first to third on a single to it being really, really close from first to third to a single. And then the next level was, well, you know, I was out a time or two, not every time. And then when you really know you're getting there, that's when you're between second and third on your way and saying, what in the hell was I thinking? And then finally there is the capitulation stage when you just stop at second base.
Well, we played this softball tournament, I'm going to say 8 years ago, 9 years ago. I mean, so I was, you know, I was up there playing, and I pitched the first two games, and then we had to sit for two games, and I told my nephew, "Hey, buddy, you're pitching." It's gonna. I was already sore, you know, type of thing. I could have probably have gone another game, keep it going, but you know, but boy, once you stop, anyway. But no, when Messi looks to me, I would never have guessed this was his sixth. In his. Get this question to Mike. In his particular position, Mike, does he get to sort of relax a little? I mean, when the ball's on the other?
When they're on defense, he's not doing too much at all. Unless the game's really close. And, for instance, like Messi's done very well in the first two games. He scored 5 goals. I think Argentina will rest him, or else they'll play him only the first half. So he will get sufficient rest in this, or during this next game, that he'll be fully capable in the first round of the knockout round. So,
well, there was a real interesting question that is Quora yesterday. Some people ask the weirdest stuff, and guys somehow or another spend their time answering. It was, who gets the most rest in an NFL game, and what position? It was pretty interesting. And he says, well, there's only 11 minutes of action, really, in a three-hour game. So for 11 minutes, people are doing something. But if you're an offensive lineman or a defensive lineman, every play when you're out there, you're doing something. But if you're a wide receiver, if the running play's to the other side of the field, I mean, you might sneak down somewhere to see if it gets away. You might need to do a block. But by and large, some positions you can take plays off. And others, you know, and they talk about a long snapper only does it 5 times a game or 6 times a game. And it was pretty interesting. He pretty much went down, like, every position as to whether you're engaged every play or not. And it was pretty interesting. I mean, a lot of guys, see, you're really only engaged 3 minutes a game, you know, or 2.5 in some of the positions. Or a long snapper, it's how long is a normal play? 6 seconds, 5 seconds?
I mean, yeah, and the long snapper, it used to be, you know, that people would line up and just beat the crap out of you, but they can't do that anymore. The rules don't allow it, so... you know, it that's like the ultimate job. You know, for our listeners, any of our young listeners out there, if you have a child, teach your child the long snap, because there's a good professional career to be had. You know, you can do it for a long time if you're really good. You just have to be really good. You have to put the ball right where it belongs every single time, and you too can be Patrick Manley.
Yeah, or you can be well, she was about 6 foot. I would say you could be Jenny Finch if it's your daughter. Teach her how to pitch softball.
All right.
Yeah, that's hard on the arm. The long snapper, you know, that's just a few plays every game. And unless historically, like Patrick Manley, you were with the Bears for 15 years or 17 years or whatever his number was, in which case you're snapping for a whole lot of punts every game.
So, Mike, next week we'll know the 32, right, by next Wednesday?
I hope so, yes.
But there'll be none of those games will be before next Wednesday.
I don't think so, but there may be. No, I think we have to go a full another week at least, because it's taken them a week for each round of games.
So
I just want to give a shout out, Pat, Tom, to my son who you knew or do know. Gene and I are leaving for Carlisle, Pennsylvania my son graduates from the Army War College this weekend. Wow. So that's where we're on the road today. So
your son, Eisenhower, what's the difference?
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't that where Eisenhower went?
He might have gone there, right. And George Marshall probably went there also.
So after Eisenhower was West Point, Marshall was...
Marshall was VMI, I think.
And, but they both went to... So who gets to go to... Since you brought it up, who gets to go to the... War College, what level, and is it...
Colonels, usually, guys that are going to go into brigade command. And then later this summer, like at the end of July, my son assumes command of a brigade in El Paso, but that's another story. So.
But now this is all Army. There's no Marine, Navy guys.
This is all Army. That's correct.
But he
has served with the Marines before twice in Afghanistan. So.
But it seemed like... again, we'll talk about this for a second, but it seemed like they teach a lot of stuff there other than war. So that's where Eisenhower and Marshall learned about dealing with people of other countries, generals of other countries. That's where they learned all that diplomacy stuff too. Is that true?
That's true, yes. And they learn how to work jointly in all the senior staff colleges. That's what the war college is, and the Navy War College. They all teach them how to work with allies and with other U.S. forces.
So there is a Navy War College and an Air Force War College, or there's three of them?
And there's probably, no, the Marine Corps would go to the Navy. So, yes, there's at least three of them.
Well, cool. Well, have a nice time. Tell everybody I said hi. I met your son that one night when he was in Afghanistan when I met him.
You helped him get a job, I think, at one point as a bicycle courier, actually.
But he was we were at Ceres the one night when he was in Afghanistan.
Oh, okay. All right. Oh, when we went to the Shamrock Series. Yeah.
Yeah. That was cool. I really liked him. So tell him I said hi.
All right.
All right, buddy. Take care.
All right.
Kevin, we'll talk Friday, bud. We a lot of stuff going on this week.
And I wanted to catch you up a little bit on some of the Fauci stuff, and it's actually a good story that goes back to 2014. So we'll talk about that a little bit on Friday.
Kevin, how did that guy manage to fool like five presidents?
I don't know, 50 years, and it's amazing that this has become a left versus right thing, because he was around for so many different administrations, and it was part of it. So I don't understand that. I do hope, just real quickly, I know they've subpoenaed him to come back and testify. He has immunity, so if they ask him point blank, did you lie to Congress before? He has to tell the truth about that. He can't plead the fifth because he has immunity, and so he can answer yes, and he can't be prosecuted for it. If he answers no, he doesn't have immunity for his testimony the next time he appears before Congress.
What immunity does he have?
To see how they pin him down.
Right. What immunity does he have? Congress give him immunity, or is he pardoned?
No, the president pardoned him for everything dating back to 2014, to January of 2014, and that's why this is an interesting story. You have to understand what was going on January 2014. And we'll talk about it. I mean, this is involved, and Russell's in the queue. And
he goes back to the AIDS stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. But, his AIDS stuff is a big problem, but his immunity has to do with any crimes committed back, as recently as 2014. So this ties into the, what was involved in Obama's ban on gain-of-function research, which wasn't really a ban, it was an outsourcing. And where, how did that fit in? What was Fauci's role? And what was going on in Ukraine and a couple of different companies, Eco Health Alliance, and so on. It's an interesting web of stuff. And I'll step you through it on Friday.
All right. I'm going to do a little research. I think he was a Reagan appointee, wasn't he?
Oh, he might have been. Yeah, he was around 50 years. So
I mean, that's when all the AIDS stuff was, when Reagan was in. A couple guys on the trading floor that unfortunately had AIDS, too.
Yeah, he's a career bureaucrat, and, career bureaucrats are hardball politicians. So,
God. You know. All right, we'll talk Friday, bud.
All right, Russell, hi. Russell, bye. Have a good time.
Russell, how are you?
I'm doing okay. You're stuck with me today.
That's fine. I was talking about Larissa all week with everybody else.
Okay.
So it was like she was here.
Okay.
Because her views on even part of the upper K crumbling a little bit, I found fascinating, because it really dovetails in with what Hal's talking about and what Carl's talking about. I mean, it really, a lot of the guests come from totally different directions, and it's amazing how they all kind of meet in the middle, maybe without even knowing it. It's really interesting that, that's why obviously I love doing it. But what do you think of the VIX up here, VIXman, and where did yesterday come from?
Well, yeah, we never know what the spark's going to be. And, you know, I think yesterday was just people looked up and said, goodness gracious, we're expensive. How much higher can it go? And but it wasn't really, from what I could tell, any specific thing that started to weigh on tech stocks. It just doesn't take a whole lot when you know, I always equate when we're extremely overvalued in certain areas like we are right now. You know, I equate it to, you know, during a drought, kindling, you know, it takes one little spark to make things dip. And yesterday was just one of those days.
Well, I had Micron. It's the one I watch because I used that example in a seminar in 2001. So it's a stock that's stuck in my mind. It's not like I don't have any clients that have any of it. I think my Dan probably mm-hmm. does, but I'm not managing any Micron positions from anybody. I mean, that's mm-hmm. one of the stocks I just never have had. But you know, a lot of Microsoft, a lot of Apple, Nvidia, a lot of that kind of stuff. But the thing got to when it got to 1,200, I had it pushing 24 times revenue, which is, I mean, in 2001 when those stocks all collapsed, they were 11, 12 times revenue. So I've got Micron on a revenue per share basis twice as high as stuff was in 2001. And then, mm-hmm. then Carl came on, and he is the one guy that I know that can actually split apart what these people do in terms of the top seven is not the top seven anymore in terms they all move together. Because Micron and maybe a little Marvell, possibly AMD, sell a lot of this, I'll use the term lower-end memory. It's not the NVIDIA stuff, but it's...
Right.
But you're starting to get a... Because of the AI stuff and the grab in the high end, it's even dragging a lot of the lower-end stuff. I'm talking about a subject I know nothing about. To where even like regular RAM for your computer, your regular old computer, went from $100 to $500, according to Carl. So
yeah, because there was a... Yeah.
Just any... And he said, but now that is starting to break. It's not 500 anymore. It's 400. It's 350. Well, and that's where these places are very susceptible. And evidently, the Microsofts of the world, to a certain extent, I mean, they do all kinds of stuff. And the Apples, they're kind of a buyer of these guys' stuff. So it kind of hurts them. And if you notice yesterday, as Micron was down, what, $160 at one point, IBM had an $11 up day. And Microsoft had the best day they've had in a while. So they're not all the same, you know, fish in the pond at this point for something, which is, thank God I have guys like Carl and Kevin a little bit telling me about it, because otherwise most people would think, hey, they're all one of the top seven. When one goes, we all go. And it's not kind of the way it is now. There's almost like a little split in there as to who does what to the other guy.
Yeah, they're the ones that have to spend for AI and the ones that are benefiting from the AI spend. And Microsoft is one of the biggest AI spenders out there. They report on a funny year end. Their year end is June, and companies tend to be a bit more honest with their year end earnings than quarterly earnings, just because that's the ones that the officers have to attest to and could get prosecuted over. If anybody said, you know, tell me what you think is going to be the spark that really hurts the tech stocks, and I know I know Microsoft was up yesterday, but if Microsoft pops up at their annual, you know, earnings and says we just cannot sustain the amount of spend that we have to for AI, that's going to frighten a lot of people. And looking at their financials and looking at what people are predicting, their capital spend has about doubled over the last 3 years. And and goodness knows that their revenues have not, you know, doubled over the last 3 years. That's why you're seeing some of these tech companies have to issue shares and raise capital.
What do you make of what do you make of the SpaceX trying to borrow $90 billion a week and a half after their IPO? What's that all about?
That's a refinance.
Okay.
That's just a, you know, now that we're public, we're a little bit more, and we've got
shares as currency, et cetera. That's just them trying to take advantage of lower interest rates. That's not like an add-on debt. That's okay. My understanding with that.
What do you make of the different people on the show have different? I mean, I'm kind of all into this. It kind of dovetails what Carl's been talking about with the interest rates. I mean, yesterday he talked a lot about how really since 1982 we've had this incredible amount of time. You know, it's been 60 years pretty much. 45 of interest rates really, without some glitches here and there, have gone from really high to really low, and the market and the government action that's caused that to happen and all those kinds of things, that it's caused this massive mentality regarding the market. Because I was jostling them back and forth yesterday, which I love to do, only because I get more information out of them, not because I was disagreeing. The thing that I think it's, and he starts talking about Fed interest rates and where they were in 82 and where, all that kind of stuff. So he's saying that these interest rates are never going back down to this 2-3% or 1% number, because look at how much the government's spending, and they've got to keep borrowing and borrowing. And some of our lenders, like Japan and the UK and so forth, aren't in as better shape as we'd like them to be. So he's convinced that these interest rates are going to continue to grind up. And this week they actually have jumped up. That it essentially is a death knell for a market price like this. And what I was kind of cautioning him with is, careful with that. You're probably right, but the statistic that I dug one snowy Saturday morning, Russell, and this one, out of all the things that I didn't notice at the time, one of the most stunning things that I have ever come across is when I started the business, and I said this yesterday, but it's worth repeating. CD rates were 15.5, pushing 16.
Yeah.
And this is in, I'm going to say, January of 81. They got as high as they were going to get, okay? And so they came down over the next... So you sit there, and when I came into the business, I didn't have any money in my account, minimum. But I was sitting there going, holy crap, Batman. The only way for this market to go is up, because the only way for interest rates to go is down, or else we're going to collapse. And I didn't think that. I figured somebody is going to apply the fix someplace. And it turns out, Volcker got put in and those kinds of things. And they put in, I don't like a lot of stuff Volcker did, but it's another story. But we started going the other way. But the key in this element of what my conversation here is not that markets did turn around and go up, but for the next 18 months to August of 82, maybe make that 19 months, these CD rates went from 15.5 to 12. So it was well on its way to doing exactly what I suspected. However, in that 18-month period, the market dropped another 20%. So the lag time in people's mentality, it didn't matter. They still... I mean, it did. In June of 82, you could have gone to a garden party, in the Hamptons. What was the Great Gatsby, West Egg or East Egg? Your pinky in the air, and if you'd have said, "I'm going to cash in my CD, go down and buy a stock," nobody in 14 years had made any money on stocks. Nobody. We were at the same level we were in '68, for God's sake. So the idea to change the mentality around. So when Carl was talking about this yesterday, and very well, but I keep jabbing him to get more information out of him. Yesterday, at his side of the coin, he's saying this is becoming so damn obvious that if these interest rates are only going to go up, long-term rates, not precipitously, but up, that at that rate, every time one of these companies goes to refinance, they're going to be paying more on their debt, which they couldn't wait to go get it, 2 and 3%, right? So now, every time they do that, the cost gets higher. And I said, but Carl, careful with that, because yesterday, we were down 1,000 in the NASDAQ, yesterday, and 100 in the SPOOS. But I guarantee you, across the country today, if there's 1,000 calls going to brokerage firms, 950 of them are, should we buy this dip? It's been so long that every time something bad happens, you buy, and you've been rewarded for it.
It just keeps working.
It's going to be years before the market could be half what it is now, and there's still going to be people wanting to buy the dip. I mean, I remember, you remember the name Joe Granville?
Yeah.
Well, Joe Granville was, actually, I have a book here.
He's a psycho guy.
The next time you come by, he actually has a very detailed, very high math, you probably understand that, me, book on technical analysis that is supposed to be really, really good. But Joe Granville stopped essentially looking at his own book, and every day after the rally started in August of 82, he used to put out a flyer that First Stop would get and give it to all their market makers. On top of his page every day was sell all stocks. He was so in tune to the last 15 years that he couldn't change. Even though interest rates are now piling down and the market's going up every day, it was obvious to everybody that we had turned a corner. Now, that didn't mean it was going to go up the next day, obviously. But he was like the Tom Lee of his time, where no matter what happens, whenever the market goes down, it turns back up, they put this Tom Lee guy on CNBC, and he's talking about, you got to buy it, boy, any kind of dip. You don't have no idea what a great bargain a stock that was, you know, $1,200 is now trading, you know, $1,198, what a steal it is there. And every time they put the guy up there, he's the Joe Granville of his time. And yet, but you know what? He's been right for 20 years. So how do you not put him on? I mean, what I just said, I just was wandering around there. What do you make of all that?
Oh, as far as?
I mean, the lag time, the mentality time.
Well, it always, you know, and I've talked about how we tend to be a lot closer to this than most people. And it takes, you know, the most people starting to change the way that their behaviors are to really make a trend change in the overall markets. So yeah, the buy on weakness thing, it will, as Mr. Bittman used to put over at the Options Institute, it will work until it doesn't. And, you know, it'll take two or three dips that don't fully recover that, you know, exhaust people trying to buy the dip. But we're, you know, as long as that keeps working, it's going to kind of feed on itself.
Well, what would it take? And by the way, I'm not recommending this at all, but what would it take? I'm going to say that, pick a number, 40 million people have a 401k plan. And we have people here that have IRAs that send us money every month. But let's say it's a 401k. I'm gonna guess out of the 40 million people, 35 of them have the money going into some sort of a index fund, Q fund, high-tech fund, high-growth fund, something. What would it take for half of those people to call their guy and say, hey, wait a minute, next week I want to go into a money market fund? How low would the market have to go before those calls start to be made? I think guys will give up all their money. And again, I'm not advocating this, and I'm not preaching it, and I sure as hell hope it doesn't happen, because I got a lot of people that are long stock, including me. But what would it take for those guys to say, I'm not doing that anymore?
I think it would be situationally dependent. If everything I had was in stocks right now, pushing 60, it'd probably take a 5 or 10% sell off where I'd be like, I gotta get involved in a little capital, in saving my capital here. So I think it's a somewhat dependent on people's risk tolerance and, you know, what you're going to be using the money for, et cetera. You know, there's a big generation of people that are closer to retirement that would be a lot more sensitive to those types of things, and who also lived through some of the really nasty sell-offs. So I do think some of the older investors would definitely be quicker to maybe hit the exits than some of the younger ones.
How can I say this politically correctly? Depends on the old person.
Yeah.
Well, when I say it, my clients, the clients of PTI, a lot of them are here because they know I can maneuver with options and stuff for them. I can tweak the risk-reward curve. I can make it less, you know, less risky. I can do all kinds of things because that's what I'm good at. I can personally redo everybody's thing. Okay, but we've also done, our Wall Street Advisor group has done subcontracting work for bigger groups that have money and they want to have a protected arm of it, and they send us that money. Okay, and we manage that. And I talked to those people. Russell, mm-hmm. these people are 75, 80. And if they're not in the hottest thing last week, they're pissed. I mean, what do you mean I wasn't in Micron? What's the matter with you? Everybody was in Micron. I go, you know, wait a minute, not everybody.
No, everybody was not.
By the way, you, when we talked before, you wanted to be in the S&P, not the Qs. Yeah, but that was before the Qs went up. You're supposed that kind of there was no hint whatsoever in that half of these guys. They were way more, you know, wild to the upside, chase the return of anybody 50. It's mm-hmm. a, you know, the age is not. Don't think. Let's put it this way: don't think old people think like old people are supposed to think in a lot of ways. I mean, when you and I were young, the plan was, and I never really agreed with it, because you and I can maneuver using puts and calls. We can maneuver the risk curve, but if you couldn't do that, if somebody was 65, well then what was the you know, if you went to any other place, when I say any other place, any money management group, if you're 65, they're going to say 40% stock, 30% bonds, 30% cash. That would have been, and if you were 60, it would have been, you know, 45% stock, you know, whatever, 35% bonds, and there was like a, for every one of your years, your pie changed, right? Well, right. None of that made sense. As a matter of fact, Joe Kernan, the guy on CNBC, and this was so difficult when interest rates got to 1.5%, and he was on TV, and I don't usually use this, but I yelled at the TV, I go, Joe, you idiot, I mean, which he's not, by the way, I happen to like the guy, but he said, the Fed is forcing you further out on the risk curve, and like, you just better do it. And I said, I'm sitting there going, okay, Joe, let's say your pops is my client and he's 84. How the hell do I shove him out on the risk curve just because of Fed policy? It may turn out to be the right move, but how do I not realize that he's no longer working? This is all the money we got to work with. And oh, by the way, go buy the riskiest stock because the Fed will take care of me. I mean, it's a big, big difference to say it. It's quite another to do it for somebody.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Just saying. So, so what are you seeing on the on your side, on the VIX? And you know, I mean, it seems when you see this SpaceX, you see this Micron, these numbers flying around like this. What does it do to you? I mean, if you're writing a book today, which you probably are, what is the chapter of the last 6 months? What would that chapter in your book sound like?
Well, and I feel like I sound like a broken record when I keep talking about this, but, you know, the heightened volatility that we've been experiencing is the kind of stuff that you usually deal with around market tops. It just seems to have gone on for a bit longer than I ever would have expected it to. You know, we've continued to make new highs in the S&P 500, and I haven't run the numbers in a little while, but the average VIX for, you know, over the last couple of years when we're making new highs on the S&P 500 is like 4 or 5 points higher than the average VIX when you've made S&P 500 new highs going back over all of history. So it's like, we continue to climb this, you know, climb to higher highs, but a lot of money managers are, you know, paying up for some protection against the S&P selling off.
Russell, where are you getting? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to poke a hole at you here, but this is my memory versus your actual having the numbers in front of you, right? So I'm going to say before I start this conversation, you're right and I'm wrong, but I'm going to say from memory, if there was a VIX, the lowest the VIX ever got would be the August before the crash of 87. I think the implied volatility in the OEX got down to like 9. And in 2007, that's why PTI was Money Manager of the Year at the Morningstar. The puts were so cheap when we were at that top that when people were giving me money and I was doing our program, I was buying the S&P and I was buying puts, I said to my brother, I go, Dan, these things are so cheap and the market's so high, why don't we buy 50% more? It was costing us nothing. Mm-hmm. And so those two market tops were just kind of the opposite of what you're talking about. In the 2 months before the 87 crash, somebody made up about 500 buttons on the floor and people stuck them on their jacket saying, just say no to puts. Because every day.
No, yeah. You're saying the same thing I am.
Well, I thought you said the volatility being high means, I mean, in those two times, there was no hint of volatility being high. It was the other way around.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it was recently, it's been volatility has been much higher as we're making new highs in the S&P 500. It's like, you know, I don't know if, you know, if so many people being hedged makes it easier for them to continue to put money into the market or what. But, you know, there's definitely a lot more risk priced into the equity markets when we've been making recent new highs relative to the amount of risk that was being priced in when we were making previous highs.
What do you make of, like, the market? What I've noticed, two things, and again, I'd love to have you on today because I got these questions, and what else can I ask? There doesn't seem to be as much put skew as I remember at these kind of times in some of these stocks. The volatility is kind of the same all the way down. It used to get a lot of put skew, but I also noticed that, you know, we do a lot of, you know, sometimes we'll do a, let's say Microsoft, if we have some Microsoft here, it's 371, okay? Sometimes instead of selling calls, we'll do, well, it can be some people would call it a repair strategy, but there's nothing to repair. But mm-hmm. Some people would call it, Marty O'Connell used to call it a bull vertical, where we might buy the, you know, the 85s, 385s, sell the 390s or something, 392s next week if we can get it for even. So if it rallies up, we've got, you know, we're actually pretty long for a while, you know, as long mm-hmm. as it doesn't blow through 90. But I notice when it works for us, if we can get a credit for it, the little calls never come down. I mean, you're never going to get them back for a penny or two or three. I mean, they don't. You have to hang in there the last day and let them go out worthless. Nobody is willing to sell you that stuff. And the people that I have an adult beverage with once in a while that work for a couple of these really big firms, their positions must be so huge. And isn't the minimum margin even for a proprietary firm like $25 an option or something? They're not willing to sell these things at 2 and 3 cents. It's just not worth it for them. Mm-hmm. And nobody is. So you can't get the stuff in like you think you would. I don't know if you noticed that when
I usually let those things run off, but I had a few that did last week. So I'm just trying to think of the markets that I never really thought about, you know, buying one back at a penny just to get out of it.
Well, because we try to, because, you know, you don't want to wait all week for something to. But I'm looking at this Micron. Micron yesterday was down like almost, what, $180 or something. Well, this morning it's up 45, so we're at 1097. So we started the day at 1050. The 1120 calls for Friday, $40.
Yeah, it's earnings.
You got to pay to play in these things. I mean, you know, it's not like
it's earnings tonight after the close.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you have a call?
Oh gosh, no. It's such a crapshoot right now with the, because you never, I mean, they may have sold everything that they can hand over fist, but then they say, you know, we're going to have a heck of a time trying to keep up with, you know, with the ability to create everything everybody wants, and everybody will take that as a negative. So,
what's your guess on the straddle?
On the strap, where is it priced right now?
Yeah, for Friday.
150.
Anybody doesn't realize this Russell's pretty damn good, 144 or something.
Yeah, about a 15%. Well, it's pretty easy to
actually 140. So you're off by $10. Everything I said, you know, it's. So that means you're a buyer if you thought it was worth 150.
No.
With the straddle.
I mean, that's you're talking about a 15% move.
Yeah, but what we're talking about is when you look at that's what. The thing that's so fascinating about options that I find, Russell, it's almost like, I'll use the term, it's almost like car insurance, you know, because the price dictates sometimes the strategy. I mean, it's one thing to say, gee, I'll just buy some Micron and I'll buy some puts. Okay, well, that's fine. If you go out and pay $1,000 for the stock and you find out the insurance for, like, the next 3 days is $70, you might go, what the hell? And I could see, let's say Russell walks into the Chevy dealer and he sees a Corvette, and it's $85,000. Russell goes, eh, I can pay that. And you call your insurance guy, and he goes, go ahead, buy it. It's like $10,000 a year for insurance. You're going to go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, what do I have to chain this thing to the curb? So options, the price dictates a lot of times your actions, right? Whether you buy the collar to put or to spread or whatever like that. But when we talk about the straddle, if a stock's trading 1,000, straddle is the combination of the 1,000, the 1,000 call and the 1,000 put. So if it's trading, say, if it's 200 and expires on Friday and it's Wednesday morning, that's the market's estimation of how much this is likely to move plus or minus between now and Friday, which is a lot. I mean, it's, you know, 15-20%. That's a real number. We gotta go to break, bud. We'll be right back. SP Futures up 25. We're trying to come back here. NASDAQ Futures up 175. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How would you like to save money on nearly all your prescription drugs? We've set up a special toll-free number for the RX Outreach Program. They're a nonprofit company whose mission it is to make prescription drugs more affordable to the masses. They don't take insurance, and in many cases, your prescriptions are even cheaper than your co-pays. They carry thousands of different prescription drugs, so whatever you're taking, there's a good chance they have it. No coupons are required, and this is not a discount card. It is pure savings on your prescription drugs. They specialize in generic meds for any chronic health needs you have. Call with your prescription and find out for free how little you can pay for your prescription drugs. Remember, we don't take insurance, so call right now.
800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. That's 800-586-9885.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 22. NASDAQ Futures up 165. This is after a horrendous day yesterday, and as Russell and I have been talking about, Micron earnings are tonight, so that'll be Micron has run up, that traded 1,200 plus yesterday, then it was down $170, and then almost was down 200 at one point. Now it's up 44 today, so it's pretty much all over the place. You know, this other stuff was up and down a lot yesterday. Marvell, same way. AMD, same way. So we're getting 2 and 3 and 4% moves in stocks, which is really, well, it may be the new normal, but it's not the normal. Nikkei down 0.9%. Hang Seng up 75.3%. Shanghai up 4. Call that flat. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 201. That's 0.8%. We've got the FTSE up 16.2%. Yekaran up 39.5%. So, you know, everything is kind of, these guys are like halfway between where we were in the close last night and where we are now. Bonds down 4 basis points, 4.45. They went over 4.5 the other day and then have come back the other way a little bit, kind of surprisingly. Oil down 215. It's pretty much where it was, I think. I saw the headline this morning to when the war started. When that notches against lowest level since before the war. But no, before the war was still lower. Sorry about that. RBOB down 5 cents, 290. Again, so add your 85 to buck something, depending on state you're in. Indiana, I think maybe you're only adding about 50 cents because they took the entire state gas tax off. So Indiana might be one of the cheapest places to get gas right now. Gold down 124. Gold just getting hammered, down 4,024. Silver down 3, 58.93. Glad we got puts in our gold and silver position. I wish we had more. We should have two puts, not one. Foreign exchange, and here's the story on that. Dollar is at 13-month high, and we get Russell to comment on this. Talking about euro is 113. It was 117. It's almost a percent and a half, two. That's a big number for some kind of an international company if you're not the right way. British pound, 131.6. It was 136 almost. I mean, these are big moves. Bitcoin up 451, 62, 732. Finally an up move for those guys. What do you got for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
All right, it is 737 here in Chicago, Wednesday, June 24th. Nothing too crazy this week, except I guess the craziest things, we do actually have some wins here in the sports. The Cubs won over the Mets 9-6. Sox won over the Guardians 2-1, and the Diamondbacks won over the Cardinals 3-4. Now, where things get a little bit more tame, for Chicago weather is currently 67 degrees. We're going to have a high of 74. It's going to be a mix of clouds and sun throughout the day, with maybe a mix of showers and a possible thunderstorm in the afternoon. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 91 degrees. They're going to have clear and pretty hot skies with a high of 111 today. And finally, for Chicago traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose is going to take you 26 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 41. Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 30 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th is 26 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 32 minutes. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, what does this kind of move in the dollar really sort of mean? I mean, if you're caught the wrong way, I mean, if you're an importer, this is good for you, obviously. But a lot of companies mm-hmm. and stuff goes back and forth, sometimes a couple of times. I mean, if a 1.5-2% move, what would you say the currency transactions worldwide are per day compared to the stock market? It's got to be three times as much, four times?
Oh, at minimum. I mean, it's multiples of what trades in the U.S. stock-wise every day, for sure.
Do any of that stuff on exchanges anymore?
The currency stuff?
Yeah.
Well, there's some currency futures, but they seem to have... I feel like they were a lot more active 30 years ago than they are now.
Exchanges, yeah. This kind of trading has always been a little pocket that the banks have always done for people. And the exchanges
they don't want it on exchange.
No, I'll give you a quick example. My stepfather worked for a place called Waltham Watch and Hallmark Rings. I'm sure you maybe not have heard of Waltham Watches, but I'm sure you heard of Hallmark Rings. They made rings forever, and they probably still around someplace. And they would import all the movements of the watches, this is before digital watches, from Switzerland. So they would always try, you know, they had to essentially buy the Swiss francs to buy the watches. So when I talk about currency moves, you know, they had a line of credit from the bank, and I think they were Continental, I'm not sure. But Continental would always say, oh, no, you're going to hedge this forward. Well, of course, Continental would hedge it for them at their price, right?
Yeah.
And they didn't want that business. So these were all essentially over-the-counter transactions. So when I remember one time, Russell, I was driving him somewhere. He had a minor stroke, so I was driving him for a while. And all of a sudden, there's this thing on TV about the dollar was getting hammered at one point. This has to be 70s. We're listening there, and this they were buying watches for Christmas. They knew they had to pay the Swiss francs in say September. This is like June, and so they were buying Swiss francs forward.
Yeah,
and which means you're locking in the price of your Swiss franc, sort of like you do with corn if you're a farmer or Kellogg's or something. Same principle. So they would lock their stuff in, and the guy. So they interviewed some guy at the radio, and he goes, yeah, these dirty currency speculators are beating up on the dollar. So I turned my head. His name was Walter. I said, hey, Walt, you're one of these dirty speculators.
He is one of these dirty speculators, yeah.
Which, in a sense, he was, but he also was just protecting himself. So, I mean, there's not much difference between the two. So right now, if you were buying a whole bunch of stuff, say, from Germany, say, a Mercedes's, right now, you're going to get those Mercedes's 2% cheaper than you did 6 weeks ago, and Mercedes better have hedged, or else they're out to 2%, right? Mercedes in Germany.
The thing with the currency and the way that it was very important back when I'm in school, and I don't feel like it's as important now, is the way a lot of companies diversify themselves is they just put production where their revenues come from,
right?
And you back it, you know. When I was in college, there were no BMWs made in the United States. Now they're all made in South Carolina.
Well, they're assembled.
Yeah, well, that's where they come off the thing.
Right, but I'm going to guess they're still buying the engine and transmissions from Germany.
They probably. I have no idea what parts come from where, et cetera. But the point is that they've diversified their costs, so they don't have to worry as much about you know, being on the wrong side of a currency move with respect to revenues, the because the revenue and the cost somewhat offset each other.
Well, you're right.
I mean, my assumption on the currency move out of Europe is they're having some real problems with a heat wave, and their energy costs are off the charts to the upside. And we've become much more of a primary supplier to them, because they can't really turn to they can't look east. They got to look west. So my feeling is that that's what may be going on with the euro right now.
I think you're probably right on that. And yeah. I wonder if it wasn't part of our plan. I mean, it's hard to imagine.
Anything that benefits us was part of our master plan. You know that.
Yeah. Well, but then you got to be careful. Who's the us?
Yeah.
Are you and I part of that us?
What kind of us are you?
Yeah. What kind of? It's like a.
Are you the one that's just saying you're part of us? Or, yeah. You know.
I mean, I always.
Are you a real American?
If ever you want to have an insane conversation with somebody from an economic point of view, not on a personal point of view, because these are all my friends. All you have to do is say, you know, what are we doing with a Bears stadium? Paying money for a stadium. Well, we're going to get a Super Bowl. Okay, who's we, Batman? Well, we. Yeah. Chicago. Are you and I going to get a hot dog stand at the Super Bowl game? Well, no. So other than inconvenience, what exactly do we get out of this? I mean, who's we? I mean, you always got to ask. I mean, are we the guy who bought the refineries in the Gulf Coast out of bankruptcy 2 weeks before we kicked the people out of Venezuela and started importing their oil to this guy's refineries? Do you have shares in that company? I don't. Do you?
Nope.
I mean, it's a. I mean, you like to see other people do well. And in, I'll say in our day, I think we're still in our day. But Russell, there was a time where you really didn't. And I wonder. See, you have the resources to study this. I don't. I just have suspicions, because I try and. I mean, you and Larissa and Hal, to a certain extent, Kevin, are serious professors. And I look at your points of view and how sometimes they're different than what the people at the University of Chicago used to say in those days. And then I look to see how much things are different than those days. And the disagreements between what you guys talk about and what they used to talk about are kind of right there in the difference of the scope of the problem. You know what I'm saying? If for instance, somebody in Chicago, you know, smoked some deal with the government, with Trump or Obama, whoever the hell the guy happened to be, or a lady, if we ever get one, and they all of a sudden get 10% extra, they get a sweet deal from the government, you know, of some kind. You know, I care to a certain extent, but if the dude is eating dinner at the same restaurant I'm eating dinner in, buying gas or shopping with you or your wife, and the money's going right into the economy here, it's kind of gets spread out a little bit. It still isn't right that somebody got a sweetheart deal, but it gets sort of spread out. I don't know that if that deal goes to Elon Musk, it's getting spread out anywhere here. It's kind of a different dynamic, I think. So you have to be real careful. I don't know that this guy who bought these refineries down there and is making all his money on Venezuela and all, does he even live in the U.S.? I mean, he may not. Where is it? If he lives in Buffalo, and all the money's being spent in Buffalo, and everybody's benefiting for it, and the government's getting their 35% back on taxes, you know what? I can sort of live with it. But I don't know that that's happening. Do you?
You know, with the oil out of Venezuela.
Well, the guy bought the refineries that was the reason for the pipeline and everything. The refineries that deal with that real heavy crap that comes up from Venezuela. Every refinery is set up for a certain type of oil. You can't put the stuff from the fracking down there. You can't put, you know, West Texas light or Venezuelan light. You can't pour that into that refinery. That's why the pipeline that came through that Biden ixnayed the one that was going to go through Nebraska.
Yeah.
That was Canadian tar sands oil down to these refineries to replace the Venezuelan oil they were no longer getting. And but yet people were dumb enough, and I'll say that, or uninformed enough, they thought that oil was like destined for Whiting, Indiana, and the gas prices here would go down. No, it wasn't. Whiting wants no more to do with that oil than I do with arsenic. There's no way you could have. So some people now, is that guy who's benefiting from all this, where does he live? I mean, does he live on an island like Dr. No, or does he live down the block from me? I don't know.
I don't know. There's not really a we on that one. There's some really smart guy benefited.
Yeah. And it's in bankruptcy. Nobody wants a place, and all of a sudden the guy buys it out of bankruptcy. Well, that's a nice piece of information. Just saying. Anyway. So the lovely Larissa, every time she's here, she brings up something about how all this stuff applies to regular people. If she was here this week, what do you think she'd say?
Things aren't getting any better for regular people.
You think they're getting worse?
Yeah, well, luckily gas prices seem to be coming down slightly, but I think there are a lot of difficult decisions that the lower end consumer is having to make these days.
I think I shipped it to her, but like I say, next week if I get to talk to her, the one thing I sent, and again, you guys get so many emails, you don't need the stuff from me, but. I've got one that said for the first quarter of this year, I don't think it's a record quarter total, but it was a record quarter for the first quarter, $47 billion was lent to people based on housing values. In other words, either a second uh-huh. mortgage or, whatever you get when you're going to redo the kitchen and you borrow the money from the... Or people closed out the mortgage and got one of those where they get money out over time or something. What do they call those, like the negative mortgages you get when you're older?
The reverse mortgage. Yeah.
They said $47 billion is like a big-time new record for the first quarter. What is that? I mean, what does that tell you? What if housing prices go
down?
That
is truly almost an act of desperation for some people.
Well, Nancy says...
That means that... Yeah, you've got no other real sources of capital to live off of at this point.
Well, it could be you're putting on a remodel instead of buying a new house.
These target retirees.
Okay.
That's the reverse mortgage where you're basically getting money out of the house and not having to make any payments, but eventually the house reverts to the holder of the reverse mortgage. Those are kind of predatory. So that's that's a pretty frightening statistic to me.
I think half of it, it's like half that and half just borrowing money. It's like half and half. Maybe a little more half on the borrowing money part. I mean, Nancy talks about... even if you have a 3% mortgage, you say, why would you ever give up a 3% mortgage? Well, if you've got, $50,000 left on the house, and you got $50,000 on your credit cards at 18 or 20%, you do the math, you're better off with a 6% mortgage, right? On all of it, because 3 plus 20 divided by 2 is like, 11.5, right? But by my math, is...
Very close to that. Yeah. That's right.
And, how susceptible, I can't talk to real estate people as in my significant other odd, but how susceptible is the economy to a 10 or 20%, 25% drop in housing prices? What do you think happens if that happens?
Oh, that could be catastrophic because, that's where a big portion of just about everybody's wealth comes from.
Do you find that...
Yeah.
I mean, I like firing back at Carl when he talks about stuff being doomsday, which, and I agree with where it may be heading in terms of total. But how do you? Oh, I know what a question I wanted to ask you. How do you tell somebody in Congress or the White House that, you know, 1.2% or 120% debt over GDP is really awful when Japan's 250 and somehow they're still alive. I mean, how do you...
Yeah, that's... And I've been... My whole life, I've heard nothing but, you know, the government deficit, we're going to end up having to pay for it. Government deficit, we're going to end up having to pay for it. And it doesn't seem like there's ever been a reckoning. So, you know, much like the psychology behind the buying the stock market on even small weakness continues to work, you know, why should I fret myself with, you know, what the repercussions of the government taking on too much debt's going to be?
Well,
you know, I mean, there's a whole, but I think there are a lot of people in Congress that just believe all you got to do, if they prove something, all you got to do is print the money, that you don't really have to pay for it with taxes.
Well,
that creates a really nasty situation.
Well, you and I know, as investors and managers of other people's money, if you decide, well, you really love IBM or you really hate IBM, and you buy it or you sell it based on the knowledge you know you have that nobody else has, right? Everybody who buys something thinks they know something more than the guy who sold it to them, right? I mean, duh. But to think that everybody else is going to read the Wall Street Journal by noon and you're going to make your money like today is like really ignorant. I mean, you may... I tell you, remember, Dr. J and I and Benji, what the hell is his name? Benji something something. He was a Merck guy, and his dad owned a clearing firm. And there was this Armenian dude, Goran something something. And we used to do a thing on cable. It was on, what was the Channel 26 thing? We'd go over where those guys were, and we were we'd be filmed, and we were on in Rockford and who knows where else. So the four of us, it was like, you know, actually, the Traders on TV that's on CNBC.
Yeah.
That was our show, or John's show. And Dylan Radigan came and saw our show, and he sold it to CNBC. That's why John and Pete were on that show all the time. John had done the same thing here. Anyway, the guy who was on there with us, I think it was either United Healthcare, no, Tenet Healthcare. I don't know where this guy found out about something, but the dude was convinced they were like cooking the books. It's Tenet Healthcare. And he's shorting the bejesus out of this thing. And his dad had a very successful construction firm, and the dad had died. Now he's running the construction firm. And every condo he built, you know, he built a place for a four-flat condo, real nice place. He got his condo for free for the price of the other three he sold. You know, so, I mean, the guy, they knew all. Well, the guy is absolutely convinced that the Tenet Healthcare is going to zero. And he's short. Finally, I mean, he started shorting it at probably 30. And the stock went to, I'm going to say, 60 plus. And this is after the show was done. I heard that he basically got carried out feet first with all the family money and everything else was gone. Russell, it couldn't have been 2 months later that some report comes out about, I don't know what they were doing. Some president was doing something. Stock goes from like 60 to like 10 after he was out. So you got to be careful on the timing on this stuff. But I'm looking here, 1960, you know, not that far after World War II, we were 52% GDP to debt. Went down to 34% in 1980, as we paid it off, the U.S. of A. 2000, it was up to 57, not sure why, because that was long after Vietnam and stuff. Now it's 122. Now, I don't think that we can pound the table and say there's going to be a crash today. But I think if that number is 160, I don't know, the world looks as good. I mean, our interest on national debt is now higher than we spent on defense, even with the Iraq war.
Yeah.
I mean, at some number, we're going to sort of get there, but you can't really bet on the day it happens. Now, can you?
No. And, yeah, I think there have been people that have been betting on it happening for a long time and have just thrown up their hands.
And then we have Scott Bessent, who I absolutely, I don't know, every time I see the guy, I'm seething, but that's just me, comes out today and we're going to be back to 3% growth by the end of the year. In your professorial mind, with the inflation numbers that we don't believe, when do you think the last time we had 3% real growth in this country.
Oh, gosh.
70s? We're talking about
in a high interest rate environment. That would be
If you've got a 6% inflation rate, that means that the growth, the GDP, would have to be up 9%.
Yeah.
So, you know, nominal GDP would have to be up 9. Subtract the 6, and you're down to 3. I don't think we've had. I think our real growth in the last, since 2000, has been like 1% a year, and that's why.
If we're lucky.
Yeah, if we're lucky. That's why. Why I think part of really what the violence, why all the people, Democrats hating Republicans, everybody is feeling it and pointing stuff out at other. Hey, I want to lob these numbers at you, because I know you. And by the way, feel free to use them. I went back from 2000 or January 2020. April 2026, so this is some Biden, some Trump, in terms of, I got the money supply up 48% in 6.5 years. That's a real number, right? You know, Hal would say that really that is your real inflation number.
Yeah.
I'm going to say we grew a little bit, okay? So I'm going to say the real inflation number is 38 to 40, somewhere in there. The admitted inflation from the CPI is 28%. So I'm going to say roughly 60% of what it really is. And I've got the average hourly wages up like 21%. And I'm going to suggest to you, correcting my paper, that in those three numbers are 90% of all the political, individual hatred, all the stuff we see in this country is contained in those three numbers.
That they're what have pushed us to where we are now.
Yep.
Yeah, I can see that.
Everybody, I think, is... Yeah. The average person is down... He's increasing in income. Not wealth. If you get in the market, you're fine. That's why... You and I both keep saying that the risk is in the wealth, which is in the market and the housing prices. But just in terms of wages, somebody going to work, doing some stuff, he's maybe made back half of what the prices are in the last 6 years. That's awful. That's never happened in this country before. Even in wartime, that never happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't... Can you even think of time?
No, it's... I can only, you know... I see it in the younger students that, you know, don't expect to ever be able to buy a house or you know, have the same kind of expectations that we did coming out of school.
You know what I've sort of added
they
to
see
that?
It.
You know what I've sort of added to that, Russell? Right. You guys keep trying to expand my what's left of my mind. Every time I talk to the guys who work like for the FINRA and the CBO and those kinds of places, and they're good kids, but they all college degrees. They all have student loan debt. And you and I keep saying, well, do you ever see yourself owning a house? Oh, God, no. And do you ever see yourself buying a new car? Oh, God, no. But you know, I added a third question.
Right.
And this really filters into the immigrants and all these people are coming from some other place and blah, blah, blah. My next question now is, by the way, you ever going to find a girl and have a family? They look at you like you got three heads. How the hell can I afford that? I mean, they're looking to find somebody of the opposite sex for a little action on the weekend. That part we get. The thought of these guys, and they're 30 years old, 31, 30.
Yeah.
The thought of them, wait a minute, I can't afford a car. How the hell am I going to afford a family? I can't afford an apartment for myself. But
the better way that I've heard it put in is, why should I give up half my stuff?
Well, that's...
I'm not saying I agree with that, but I've heard that multiple times.
That's
from guys that are just like, I've got no intent.
Well, you know, there was a comment from back in the day when Playboy magazine was something everybody had to read because Jimmy Carter was in there. I mean, even if you didn't look at the pictures, whoever was doing the interview every month was a real guy, right? This is way back. There was a thing in there about some male views of marriage versus ladies. And the guy said something like, well, guys look at 40% or 45% of all marriages ending in divorce, and they look at it, they go, you know what? I'm pretty much like every other guy. if it's happening to 45% of people just like me, it could happen to me, and I don't want to do that. Plus, I know two buddies that just went through it, and they don't want to do it. But the way, and maybe the ladies have a better view of it, I'm not saying it's just, I think it's somewhat different, and I'm just a gross generalization, is their view is, this will never happen to me. She did something wrong. I won't do that. But guys don't think that way. They think, wait a minute, I'm part of the 50%. I'm sure that's a gross generalization, and it was a long time ago, and I don't know why I even said it, but there's different points of view on it. I mean, you're right. I mean, but now I think maybe women feel the same way. If they've got a good job and good money and marry some stiff who doesn't, they're thinking the same way. Why wouldn't they?
No. If you got a good job, you know, find somebody else that has a good job.
But just the guys I'm talking about, you're sharing an apartment with somebody because you're paying, you know, $300 or $400 a month in student loan debt. Where exactly does a family fit into that?
They don't. We're at the end here. I think there's a lot more.
There's more to it.
I think there's a lot more that guys have become aware of the actual transactional nature of, getting married. And I think they see it on raw display with all this OnlyFans crap and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
I know that younger guys are like, you know, they just want our money, and they're that type of stuff is just making them see that.
Well, remember, I mean, he was a good friend of mine when I was on the board and stuff. Bill Florsch, remember him? You know him, didn't you?
Yeah.
Bill, one of the nicest guys. He was the vice chairman of the CBOE for a while. And one day he says, we heard some commercial about that. We're driving to some board meeting. And he goes, you know, if our parents waited until they could comfortably afford us, none of us would be here. but that exactly accentuates the point of view that you and I are always talking about.
Yeah.
Our parents versus us. Our parents, when they were 30, even though they probably couldn't afford a family that day, their view was, next year is going to be better. The year from that's going to be better. By the time I'm 35, the world's going to be my oyster. These people don't feel like that. And it's sad. And they're probably right.
Yeah.
But that's why guys like you, again, for those that don't know, a week ago Friday, Russell was nice enough to invite me over to his MBA class of people who are older, not right out of school, and I was amazingly impressed. So there is some hope, Russell. Those people,
there's hope. Yeah. I see it every school year, and it's always a handful of students.
And Kevin sees it all the time with people that are they have a family come and take classes at night. So we're not. We just have to make sure that kind of stuff is easier for people to get.
Yeah.
And because what you guys are doing, I've never been as impressed as I was in that group. Especially like the lady who was the nurse.
Yeah.
Boy, she was talking about multi-talented, that young lady, for God's sake. I mean, what, she was a nurse and she works for an insurance company? I mean, for God's sake. I mean, and now she's going to get an MBA? I sure hope somebody grabs her and pays her a lot of dough, because I bet she's worth.
I think she's going to do quite well.
Anyway, bud, you keep pushing. You're one of the fixers here.
And, I'm trying.
Tell Arissa I said hello, and hopefully we'll talk to the Bodias next week, as they say in the South Side. SP Futures up 12. NASDAQ Futures now only up 85. It was up 170. So we're leaking a little, but still positive. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.